We're delighted to welcome students with us today. We have students from Bruce High School. Would those students please stand? Welcome and thank you. You may be seated. We have students from, is it Agape School? How is it pronounced?
Agape.
Agape. Good. I obviously am not familiar with your school. Would the students from Agape School please stand? Six. Thank you. And there are students from Mineral Point High School. Would they please stand? Thank you for joining us. You may be seated. The students are here with a national award-winning program called Court with Class. And under this program, students around the state are invited to join us for an oral argument. The invitation is accepted. They are sent briefs of the case that they will hear, and they may engage in some activities relating to the case. They come, listen to oral argument, and after this second case, they will meet with a justice of this court and discuss the procedures the court uses, not the substantive issues of the case. Everyone is invited to join with the justice after the second oral argument. Let me now introduce the members of the court. Starting on my far left is Justice Michael Gableman. Seated next to him is Justice Patience Rokensack. To my immediate left is Justice Patrick Brooks. I'm Shirley Abrahamson, the Chief Justice. To my right is Justice Anne Walsh Bradley. To her right, Justice David Prosser. And on the far right is Justice Annette Ziegler. With those introductions made, I will call our second case. I should ask, though, does anyone here want a summary of the case we are about to hear? The marshal has summaries. They help you listen. Fine. Okay. I will now call 07-AP-1834-CR State versus Kramer. Arguing on behalf of the defendant, Kramer, is Marcia. Is it Lyson or
Lyson? Yeah.
Lyson. Counsel, you may proceed.
Thank you. Good morning, and may it please the court. My name is Marcia Lyson, and I represent the defendant appellant petitioner in this case, Todd Lee Kramer. Today I'm asking for two things. The first is that this court find that a seizure occurred in this case when the officer pulled up behind Mr. Kramer with his emergency red and blue lights flashing. And second, I am asking that this court find that seizure was unreasonable under the community caretaker exception to the Fourth Amendment. First of all, this case is about a motorist's right to exercise caution when they're on the road and they're going to use a cell phone or a GPS device or do anything that's going to distract them from safely driving. In this case, Mr. Kramer did try to do the right thing. He parked his car to the side of the road so that he was not obstructing traffic. He put his hazard lights on to alert other drivers to his presence, and he made sure that he was completely off of the road so that there was no safety hazard being posed. And he did this so that he could use his cell phone. And in this day and age, motorists are advised many times to, rather than continue driving while using their cell phone, to pull over to the side of the road. And second, this case is about the dangerous expansion of police power under the community caretaker doctrine. In this case, the officer had very minimal information at his disposal before he conducted an immediate seizure of Mr. Kramer's vehicle. And in this case, that was unreasonable under the circumstances.
Counselor, if he had seen the same thing that we have in the record and pulled up behind his vehicle but didn't put his flashing lights on, all the other facts are the same. Would you be arguing to us that there was a seizure?
No, I don't think that it would be immediately apparent that a seizure had occurred. I think under the exact facts of this case if he had just simply used his own hazard lights or his spotlight to illuminate the scene, if he was really concerned about safety, then I think Mr. Kramer could have had an opportunity to simply go about his business and to drive away.
I think the record reflects that the officer said if he put his car in gear and started to drive away, he would have stopped him. So I guess you seem to think that that may not have been the response of the officer if the officer simply put hazard lights on, the flasher lights, instead of his rollers.
I think the officer probably would have still followed him after that, but I think that's because in this case, this really isn't a community caretaker case where he's just concerned about a motorist being disabled at the side of the road. I think this case is more about a hunch that he had, and that's why he decided to perform an immediate seizure and make sure that Mr. Kramer was not free to leave the scene. I think if he really had been concerned just about whether Mr. Kramer was in need of medical help or if his car was disabled, I don't think a seizure would have been necessary. And I don't think he would have had it in his mind that he would have followed Mr. Kramer had Mr. Kramer simply gone about his business.
What if we find no seizure here? What difference does it make?
Well, I think the difference is that if there is no seizure, then I think the state would argue that the Fourth Amendment isn't implicated. And so I think that's the defining moment in a community caretaker case. First, you have to find that a seizure occurred in order to make the officer justify those actions and to do the balancing test.
But you're conceding there was a seizure.
There was a seizure in this case, yes. And that's not...
Well, if there's no seizure, they can't use the community caretaker approach, can they?
That's correct. Under Wisconsin law, under the Anderson test, yes, you first need to find that a seizure did occur. And in this case, that was, I think, where the Court of Appeals first erred. And it wasn't necessarily an error, as in they made the wrong decision, but they didn't definitively find a seizure. And I think that in this day and age, a lot of motorists are going to find themselves in this same situation. And I think this court needs to decide if an officer pulls up behind a motorist who's parked at the side of the road, there's no indication that he's disabled or that the vehicle's damaged, as the officer in this case conceded. And there's no indication that his car poses a public safety hazard by blocking traffic.
Counsel, let me ask you this. If under the same facts, lights on, the officer stops, and instead of using his cell phone and being under the influence of an intoxicant, he's having a heart attack, is it then community caretaker?
I think that, yeah, you could argue maybe that there's a community caretaker concern, but I think we have to look at the facts known to the officer at the time of the seizure. And if we're talking about him just being concerned about somebody's safety and having a heart attack, first we have to ask, well, then why perform an immediate seizure? Why not just use your hazard lights or your spotlight to illuminate the scene? And second of all, I think it's too speculative without seeing anything more to say that a driver could have been having a heart attack.
So if I understand your argument correctly, it's the officer's belief as to what may be going on in the vehicle that should control community caretaker, and it's whether or not an officer puts the wigwags on as to whether it's community caretaker.
Yes, with respect to the seizure question, yes, the red and blue lights are certainly dispositive of the seizure question. And with respect to the officer's concerns, I think in a community caretaker case, an officer's concerns are always going to be relevant, because if they're not acting under reasonable suspicion and they're not acting under probable cause, then there's no statute or ordinance that we can look at and say, okay, these are the facts that are known to the officer, and this goes to this element of that offense, so he has reasonable suspicion right there.
Counsel, I want to follow up on Justice Ziegler's question, because I heard the difference between the question and the answer. Her question was, as I heard it anyway, whether the officer's belief should decide, and if it's community caretaker. And I heard that question to be essentially is, should the officer's belief be controlling? Should it be dispositive, the officer's subjective belief? You responded, it should be relevant. Now, I don't think that relevant and dispositive are the same thing. Maybe I misunderstood, but
can you clarify?
Yes, would you?
Okay, so under Katie v. Dombrowski, the U.S. Supreme Court case that originally recognized community caretaker, they stated that community caretaker functions are generally totally divorced from the acquisition, detection, or investigation of evidence relating to a criminal violation. And so under Katie, I think that the officer's beliefs are dispositive. Now, if this court...
Let me point you to page 33 of your brief and 34 of your brief, because you're talking about Katie, and it seems to me that you're not saying it's the officer's belief is dispositive. I'm looking at the very bottom of page 33, and you say in that last paragraph, at the beginning of that last paragraph on page 33, by creating the totally divorced rule, the Katie court renders an officer's reasons for a warrantless search or seizure relevant, while at the same time leaving the officer's actions subject to the Fourth Amendment reasonableness standard.
I think when we're talking about dispositive, I think the officer's beliefs are dispositive with respect to whether he's partaking in a bona fide community caretaker function. But when we're talking about whether his responses or his response to his concerns and his actions in reaction to his concerns are reasonable, then I think that that's an objective test, and that also comes into play.
So with regard to the normal fourth, what I say is normal, Fourth Amendment reasonable test, which is objective, that you're saying that the officer's motivations, his thoughts, his concerns, are relevant in a totality of the circumstances evaluation of objective reasonableness.
I think the officer's concerns are relevant with respect to the second part of the Anderson test. Anderson said that the first part of the test is whether a seizure occurred, and then the second part of the test was whether the officer was partaking in bona fide community caretaker activity. And I think bona fide is where Katie's totally divorced rule comes into play.
I still need to push you on this because I'm not understanding your position. So indulge me and hopefully illuminate. Totally divorced rule goes to the second prong or the second part of the Anderson test, and that is whether it's a bona fide community caretaker function. Got that. No problem. Is the totally divorced rule, as you see it, completely a subjective determination?
I don't think it's completely subjective, because I think you're going to have the testimony of any witnesses that were there. You're going to have the officer testifying about when he wrote in his police reports about what time of day it was, what time of night, what the weather was like, anything he happened to observe. But with respect to what he's concerned about when he says, well, I'm concerned someone's having a heart attack, I think that that's going to be relevant with respect to the bona fide.
Okay. So the totally divorced rule is not, you're not arguing that it's completely subjective.
Not completely.
Okay. Are you arguing that the totally divorced rule, that the subjective concerns are relevant to the determination of whether or not this is a bona fide community caretaker situation?
Yes. Yes. And I think...
And whether or not it is a bona fide community caretaker situation is ultimately an objective determination with relevant consideration of the subjective determination, right?
Yeah, I think that the subjective and objective tests are going to come into play together because, like I said before, with respect to reasonable suspicion, we have a statute or an ordinance we can look at. In community caretaker, all we have is what the officer sees and what's going on in his mind.
What's the difference between your position that the totally divorced rule is a objective determination which considers the subjective concerns or reasons as relevant? The difference between you, which I understand what I just said, your position, and what the state is arguing regarding primary motivation.
Well, I think the problem with the state's rule is that the primary motivation, in particular in this case, really couldn't be determined, or it really wouldn't work in their favor because the officer testified himself that anything...
Just stop you. I want to talk about theory first.
Okay.
What do you understand to be the state's primary motivation? Is that totally rule? Is that totally subjective, or is it objective, but the subjective is relevant in order to make an objective determination?
I think the subjective is relevant in the predominance rule that the state proposes. And I think one of the examples they used in their brief was if an officer has some reasonable suspicion or suspects something while at the same time mostly being concerned about someone's welfare, then the court should uphold the seizure as reasonable.
One final question, and then I'll let you go on to anything else you may wish. What I'm having difficulty with is this. I see, although there are places on the edges where it isn't so clear, I see both you and the state arguing for a rule that is for an objective determination where the subjective is relevant.
Yes.
So what's the difference between the two of you?
Well, I think... If, in terms of our rule, I think that the subjective would be more relevant. I think if you hear an officer saying that he had a hunch about some criminal activity, but you know, he was also concerned that someone was hurt or something like that, say for example, then I think the court would look at whether his concerns were really that reasonable in light of the fact that he had a hunch. I think it's probably a credibility determination at the trial court level. How much do we really believe that he was concerned versus how much do we believe that he was acting on a hunch?
Okay. I wasn't right because I did have one more. You say it's more relevant. Okay. What percentage of relevance is your test compared to the state's test of the subjectiveness?
Well, I think if there's any indication that the officer had something, in some suspicion in his mind about what was going on, I think that that's going to be more relevant than his concerns, because I think that when you have a suspicious officer, I think you have to be more concerned about whether he's trying to circumvent reasonable suspicion by just citing community caretaker.
More relevant, but not dispositive.
More relevant, but maybe not dispositive, because of course you're going to look at the external factors that are in play as well.
You know, part of what now I struggle with is the longer an officer has been on the road, the more an officer sees. You know, everything from somebody who's in labor about ready to deliver a baby, to someone having a heart attack, to somebody concealing a murder weapon, to somebody being under the influence, could be any of those. So when you have an officer who's been around the block a few times, they're always going to have 100 things that they might be thinking could be going on with a vehicle. Mm-hmm. So you're saying officers should stop checking on vehicles unless they're obstructing traffic or they clearly have some problems or someone's called for help? Is that the community caretaker? I'm looking at page 21 of your brief, and I'm trying to sort out what you want it to be and what you think it shouldn't be, because strikes me that all of a sudden with a seasoned officer, community caretaker no longer can apply. Because if they're telling the truth on the stand, they're thinking about almost everything that could be happening in the car.
I understand that. And I think with respect to community caretaker, I think we have to look at the officer's response to his concerns and whether those are reasonable. And I think when you're checking in a vehicle, if you perform an immediate seizure without any information that there's any criminal activity going on or that there's some kind of hazard being posed, I think that's unreasonable. But I don't think that it would be unreasonable in every case. Say you had a case like Ellenbecker, where the jumper cables are out and the hood is up and someone's outside obviously trying to get their car started again, then I think that the officer could say, well, I turned it on to illuminate the scene. It wasn't really a seizure. But
the problem is the person having the baby or the heart attack who needs some help isn't going to be outside putting their hood up.
But I think we have to look at what's the likelihood of that. What's the likelihood that in Mr. Kramer's case, he's pulled over to the side of the road, he's completely off the road, he manages to get his hazard lights on, and he's not obstructing traffic in any way. What's the likelihood then that he's able to do all that while he's having a heart attack, or that if someone is inside having a baby that they can't wave the officer down? And
depending on what stage you are.
I guess, yeah, that's true.
Human experience comes up.
That's where human experience comes up. I guess I'll find out someday. But I think we also have to look at, okay, in that case, if the officer's really concerned about that, then why perform an immediate seizure? Why not just illuminate the scene and try to see if you can learn some more? Why not use a spotlight and see if you can see if there's anybody inside that looks like they're hunched over? I don't think in this case that what the officer did was reasonable.
Okay, so really the focus is the lights. It's no longer the belief of the officer, because an officer could think almost anything's going on in that car. So really your focus is now the lights. When the lights are on, it's a seizure.
Yeah, and I think that the officer's testimony at the suppression hearing is relevant to why he turned on the lights. He testified that something criminal could have been going on, and I had no idea what was going on, but it's not a place where a car is generally parked at the side of the road. So I think there's a hunch that's going on in his mind, and I think he wants to investigate, and he wants to make sure the person is not going to leave, and I think that shows that he's a little bit more concerned than just with safety.
Maybe he's just telling the truth, that he's seen just about everything, and it could be just about anything, and he was taking the precaution to make sure everything was okay.
But if we're talking about performing a seizure, I think without reasonable suspicion, that's unreasonable. And I think if we're just concerned about safety, then you don't need to perform a seizure. If someone's really in trouble, they're not going anywhere.
Did he have his hand on the gun in this case when he approached the car?
He did. He testified that, yes, he did have his hand on the gun.
Sounds like a caretaker to me.
I think he also testified that he does that because you never know what you're going to encounter in a traffic stop.
So he's not totally a caretaker.
No. I think that that testimony is relevant to what was going on in his mind.
We're back to subjective versus objective.
Yeah, and I think in this case there's a good deal of testimony that that the officer wasn't just concerned about safety. He had the hand on the gun, he performed the immediate seizure, he said he would have followed Mr. Kramer if Mr. Kramer had left the scene. And I just think that's highly relevant when we're talking about a motorist who's trying to do the right thing, who's trying to exercise caution. And how much do we want to tell motorists who try to do the right thing that the Fourth Amendment does not protect them? How much do we want to tell the police that if they see something out of the ordinary, a car that doesn't appear to be in the right place, that they can perform a seizure? Then why not allow police to pull over any nice car that happens to be traveling through a high-crime neighborhood and warn them about the high-crime neighborhood and that they might be in danger under community caretaker?
What kind of opinion do you expect this court to write?
I think that this court's opinion should first include a definitive seizure finding in this case. I think
you want to say there's a seizure here.
Yes, there is a seizure here.
There's a seizure here because he could not leave once those lights were on.
Right, the Mendenhall test does apply here. Yes.
What test?
The Mendenhall test.
Okay. And there's a statute about leaving.
I'm sorry, what was that?
And there's a statute, isn't there?
There is. There's a fleeing statute about receiving a visual or audio signal.
All right. What else do you want the court to say?
And with respect to community caretaker, I think this court should say that without any more information at the officer's disposal, when all you have is a car that's legally parked at the side of the road, nothing else unusual, just hazard lights warning other drivers to its presence, I think in this day and age, when you have motorists who are told that you could cause an accident. It's dangerous to drive when you're talking on a cell phone, and they're trying to do the right thing. I think you need to say that's not enough to justify a seizure under community caretaker, because while there is a public interest in protecting or aiding potentially stranded motorists, there's also an equal public interest in having drivers pull over to the side of the road before they do something that's going to distract them from paying attention and potentially causing an accident. And I think there's also a public interest in not inviting yet another exception to the Fourth Amendment and even more police intrusion than we already allow.
What would you have had the officer do here? Just drive on down the road?
No, I think that we pose some feasible alternatives. I think in this case, if he had pulled up and possibly illuminated the inside of Mr. Kramer's truck and seen that Mr. Kramer did not appear to be in any distress, I think he didn't need to turn on his emergency lights. I think he could have called a tow truck. I think he could have pulled up alongside him and said...
You wouldn't call a tow truck unless you found out that the particular motorist was having trouble with his vehicle.
Mm-hmm.
Don't you have to ask?
No, I think if you see that the motorist doesn't appear to need medical aid and you're just concerned about him being disabled, I think you could call a tow truck to potentially check on the scene. But let's say you don't think that that's a feasible alternative. He also could have pulled up alongside Mr. Kramer's vehicle and waited for him to motion or rolled down his window and said, is there anything wrong? Do you need help? And I think that he could have also waited it out. I think we said that in State v. Patterson, when the officer was called to the house on a call of a potential burglary because a neighbor had spotted lights going on and off in the house and thought that something suspicious might be going on. The court said, well, the officer in this case didn't have to immediately go in and check on the situation. Just because the lights are going on inside of the house and I think the occupant or the resident of the house didn't answer the telephone. They said that's not enough to just perform an immediate warrantless search. I think in this case, when you don't have any indication that someone's in need of medical aid, there's no emergency, and the Court of Appeals did concede that there was no exigency apparent in this situation, I think you can say that he could have waited a few minutes to see if Kramer pulled away, to see if everything was okay. And I think that's reasonable in this day and age when you have motorists who pull over to the side of the road, want to use their cell phones, and just want to be safe and don't want to have to answer for their innocent actions. I think we can give them a few minutes to get off of the road if the police think that it's necessary to investigate further.
We don't know in this record how long he was off the road, do we?
No, there was no testimony about that. It was not known to the officer. The officer merely saw Mr. Kramer's vehicle at the side of the road, made a U-turn, and turned his emergency lights on and pulled up behind Mr. Kramer.
Where does the totally divorced rule come from?
The totally divorced rule comes from Katie v. Dombrowski, which was decided by the U.S. Supreme Court in 1973. And in that case, I see my red light is on. May I continue?
Yes.
Okay, thank you. In Katie v. Dombrowski, the court said that a lot of the time local police officers, they investigate motor vehicle accidents, they help disabled motorists, and these police citizen encounters are typically, they're totally divorced from the acquisition or detection or investigation of criminal activity. And I think if you say that the totally divorced rule does not apply, then we're saying that the police can circumvent reasonable suspicion with community caretaker then. And that's my concern.
Thank you, Counsel. You have 5 minutes in rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honors.
Sarah Larson, Attorney Larson, Assistant Attorney General representing the state.
Good morning. I'm Sarah Larson representing the state. And the state wants this court to clarify the law and community caretaker with respect to two interrelated issues. First, we want you to clarify that the totally divorced language in Katie, it's not a requirement, it's not a rule, it does not mean that the officer cannot have any investigatory agenda in order to act in a community caretaker capacity. If that were true, then basically the police could never be community caretakers because they always have in their mind, potentially, that's their job, to investigate crime as well as acting in community caretaker capacity. All that totally divorced means is that you just analyze the community caretaker function apart from, independently of, totally divorced from any law enforcement function that might also be present. So in other words, standing alone if they're an objectively reasonable community caretaker function that's apparent and being performed. So I want to just clarify, I want this court to clarify that the officer's subjective intent or motive does not dictate whether the Fourth Amendment is violated. It cannot. The Fourth Amendment cases are very clear that it's this objective test. So in other words, the seizure cannot be deemed unreasonable based on any subjective beliefs that the officer might have. But what I was trying to convey in the brief, and I realize I'm a little inartful in my brief about the primary motivation test, but what I was trying to say was that the officer's observations of facts or circumstances which motivated him to act in a community caretaker capacity, those observations can be relevant in determining whether the encounter was objectively reasonable or a, quote, bona fide community caretaker encounter. So the bottom line of what we're dealing with here is that the Fourth Amendment only prohibits arbitrary warrantless intrusions, unreasonable ones. It doesn't ban all intrusions by a police officer upon citizens.
Counsel, did a seizure occur at the time the officer activated the lights?
As we advocated in our brief, the state's position is that there's no seizure here. But we also believe that this court does not need to decide the seizure question in order to decide the case. They can just do, you can just do as the Court of Appeals did here and assume without deciding that a seizure did occur. Because if no seizure occurs, there's no Fourth Amendment encounter. So you don't need to justify.
Would a reasonable person have felt free to leave the scene after the officer activates the lights?
Well, I think a reasonable, innocent person, which is the Mendenhall standard, in the situation where you activate the hazard lights, a reasonable person would potentially...
Hazard lights. My understanding is these are the blue and reds.
Correct. I'm saying the person who has initiated their own hazard lights,
okay,
after which the police officer then pulls behind them and activates their own, the police officer's own red and blue lights, that person would not necessarily feel seized under the meaning of the Fourth Amendment, because they might just think, oh, they're just coming over to see what's happening, or the police officer's lights were on just because of a safety concern. And in this instance, that was the stated rationale for him to have turned on his emergency lights, that he was at the crest of a hill. Kramer even conceded that it was an unsafe place to stop. So in other words, it was blind. In order for the officer's safety, he needed to activate the lights. It's not a situation where you're on the side of a road in a city street, you're legally parked. I think Kramer's position is that it's legally parked, and it might be true that he's legally on the side of the road, but he's not really parked because he's got his lights on. He's got his emergency or hazard lights on at the top of a hill at a strange place to stop when he pulls over to take the cell phone call.
Counsel, I want to follow up Justice Gableman's question.
Yes.
And in preparing for this case and applying the Mendenhall test of a reasonable person feel free to leave, that's shorthand for the test.
Yes.
And that's determinative of whether or not there's a seizure. So I play in my mind, well, what if you're a woman that looks like Anne Walsh Bradley driving from Wausau to Madison in a decent car, how is that, and this facts like this, you know, along the road, hazard lights just like this. Or what if I were a 17-year-old in the inner city of Milwaukee driving an old car with a muffler a little loud and dressing like some 17-year-olds dress? No offense. Not present company excluded entirely, okay? So I say, does that make a difference? You know, I'm trying to think this through.
But you know what? I even think that Ann Walsh Bradley coming from Wausau to Madison, if I were along the side of the road and I had an officer come behind me with his lights flashing, I don't think I could look back and say, put the pedal to the metal, let's go. I don't think I could do that. So how does that enter the equation? Maybe I'm just unusual, but I just don't think that I would feel, I said unusual, not reasonable, you know. I don't think I would feel free to go. And indeed, both the officer and the defendant here, their sense is consistent with mine, whatever the merit that is. In other words, the officer didn't think he was free to go, and the defendant didn't think he was free to go. So rebut my comment, if you will, that a reasonable person would feel free to leave under the same circumstances.
Well, first of all, it's a reasonable, innocent person. It's not what Kramer is thinking, because Kramer...
Yeah, that's right. I'm innocent. A 17-year-old is innocent, too. Different life experiences, so that might inform what's reasonable and what's not reasonable.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think at the very instant that you're talking about, when the police officer pulls behind the car, activates the light, you know, at that very instant, probably a reasonable, innocent person would not feel free to go. But then the officer approaches... vehicle,
uh-huh.
And the very first words out of his mouth are, can I help you with something? I see that your hazard lights are on.
When in this scenario are you maintaining that a reasonable person should have felt free to leave? Tell me when that occurs.
Well, I didn't ever make that argument in our position, is that there's no seizure, but the cases go both ways. I mean, it's clearly a close call in this case. But you don't need to decide in this case whether a seizure occurred, because the important thing in the state's mind is to clarify the community caretaker doctrine, assuming without deciding seizure occurs, okay? That the community caretaker doctrine in Wisconsin, as well as other jurisdictions, has gone astray in terms of this totally divorced, quote, requirement. The state's position is that it's not a requirement at all. It originates in Katie V. Dombrowski. But all Katie was talking about was that there are facts and circumstances that have little to do with investigatory functions. The Chief Justice wrote the opinion in Bees, which is a case that you all determined, 1977, I think it was, where...
Was the garage case?
Pardon me?
The garage with the light case?
Yes, yes. And under that, you're looking at this balancing test as to whether it's reasonable or not. I don't think the case is ever... Katie V. Dombrowski never held that you could never have any scintilla of investigatory intent. I think that that would pretty much wipe out the doctrine of community caretaker.
But did you hear your opposing counsel? Because that's what I was trying to push and see what the difference between the two of you are.
Right.
You may have heard different responses, you may have heard the responses differently, but essentially I thought that as it was described, that both of you are saying with regard to whether this is a bona fide community caretaker function, that it's an objective test, but the subjective concerns are relevant to the totality of the circumstances in the objective test. Except I heard her say that the subjective concerns are more relevant, but not dispositive.
Right.
How do you differ?
I think this is where we get into trouble in the case law right now. It's very unclear how much weight you should be giving the subjective intent. And so I think that's also where I might have not been particularly artful in the brief when I'm talking about this predominating test. What I was trying to argue was that the officer's subjective belief or motivation or intent is not relevant. It cannot be controlling as to whether there is
positive, right?
Dispositive, mm-hmm. Correct. Mm-hmm. So, in other words, the community caretaker doctrine doesn't prohibit dual motivations. I think there's plenty of cases in the emergency aid context which would substantiate this. Like, contemporaneous objective to investigate should not and does not divest officers of the ability to assist others in a community caretaker capacity. Just for a few examples, it's often ambiguous what's confronting the officer until they go. And this situation is one of them. He doesn't really know what's happening. Person could be on the side of the road having a baby, having a heart attack, whatever it might be, or they may just be pulling over to have a cell phone. But the officer has no way of knowing until he makes that contact. But the functions are blended together most of the time. They're performed simultaneously in a law enforcement capacity. So as the Court of Appeals said, the officer could be assisting person A while at the same time simultaneously investigating person B. Should we be precluding the officer from assisting person A simply because he also has this other investigatory agenda? I think the answer is no.
Counsel, do you see any danger here in expanding the community caretaker test?
I don't see the dangers that opposing counsel is proposing, because you also have to, we're just dealing with the first prong of whether it's a bona fide community caretaker function, but you also have to meet the balancing test of reasonableness, whether or not the balance of the individual interest in proceeding unfettered by police interference against public interest in having police perform services, community caretaker services, that are in addition to their law enforcement functions.
And so you think it's a case-by-case type of analysis that goes on here?
It is a totality of the circumstances approach, and whether it's objectively reasonable. If that's the test that was set forth in Bees, then was subsequently adopted in the Anderson prongs.
Counsel, to follow up Justice Cook's question, if I may. In reading a little bit of the literature on the community caretaker doctrine, one of the things that is emphasized is, look, you got to be a little careful, though, because you want to deter any kind of subterfuge,
right?
And that's one of the main concerns. As your opposing counsel finished her argument, that's what she said. And my main concern, I don't have her exact words to my mind right now, but is that we don't want to expand it because it can be violative of the protections offered under the Fourth Amendment. She said, essentially, my concern is that police can circumvent, for instance, reasonable suspicion. You know, they just say community caretaker. How do you respond to that? Because that's a real valid argument that you find not only in this courtroom, but in the literature, in terms of concern that there be no opportunity for abuse or subterfuge, which would otherwise circumvent all this other case law that we have on reasonable suspicion and probable cause. Mm-hmm. How can we safeguard this?
Well, you need to isolate the community caretaker function that is apparent in the situation and just more or less disregard any law enforcement function that the officer might be communicating. And you say, is this as a standalone analysis for the encounter, apart from anything that's out there, does that in and of itself justify the encounter? So it did not justify the encounter in a couple of the cases that are cited, like Dahl and Patterson, where there's clearly the community caretaker encounter had ended, and then they were proceeding with a law enforcement function without reasonable suspicion or probable cause, and that in those cases show that there's not going to be subterfuge if you analyze the two encounters separately, initial encounter versus subsequent encounter. I think some of the exigent circumstances cases that I did not cite in my brief, but that are more along the lines of emergency aid cases, I think those support this idea of a standalone analysis or independent justification. Does the community caretaker function in and of itself justify the seizure? So, in other words, there's a case called...
How does that tie in with your with you're saying that the subjective is relevant. You're saying in and of itself, and that means no subjective, I think.
Right.
So help
and
me
I
with
need
that.
To refine the state's position a little bit in that regard, because I do think that it does get too confusing if you're having subjective intent involved. I think the cases are clear, and I didn't fully appreciate the Brigham City versus Stewart case, which basically forecloses my argument about the primary motivation. That's an emergency aid case of the United States Supreme Court that talks about this. So you can't just say, oh yeah, there's 80% community caretaker and 20% law enforcement, so therefore it's community caretaker. You can't, like,
the totality of the circumstances, right?
Right.
I mean, isn't that what we're all about? What is the test? Totality? You're getting rid of the primary motive test? Is that what you're telling us?
I think which
is on page 31 of your
right,
brief.
Page 31 to 34 of my brief is a little bit confusing, and I apologize that I'm...
That's okay.
...wasn't totally clear on the state's position there. I think that you still need to analyze... the subjective thoughts or facts of the officer in determining whether it's objectively reasonable, but the intent or motive, or it might just be semantics, but I think you can't say, oh, well, I definitely had this idea in the back of my head that it was something crazy was going on with the OWI. But if you have facts that objectively support a community caretaker function, it should be enough.
Okay, now I hear you saying that if you have,
I don't know what I hear. Sorry.
Now I hear you saying that the subjective concerns of the officer are not relevant. Maybe I'm wrong, and that's okay if I'm wrong. I'm wrong, you know.
Well, I think that the earlier emergency care aid cases in Wisconsin suggested it can be relevant, but I think that Stewart basically forecloses that argument. Subjective intent definitely cannot be dispositive, and Stewart even goes so far as to say it's not even relevant, because in that case, they were clearly investigating, but they were also helping the people who were injured in the fist fight.
How does that tie in with our Kyles case?
The Court of Appeals
cited Kyles, and in Kyles, and I'm reading from paragraph 34, which says, although cases hold, as we do, that an officer's response to such a question, the question was, you know, were you afraid? And he said, no, I wasn't afraid. This goes to the issue of officer safety. Although cases hold, as we do, that an officer's response to such a question is not determinative of reasonableness of the frisk, they also hold that a court may nonetheless consider a police officer's fear or belief that his or her safety or that of others was in danger as part of the totality of circumstances. Why not apply that kind of test here?
Well, I think that's what I was trying to get at in the brief, that you do consider the subjective facts that are perceptions that the officer is describing, saying this is why I thought I needed to help this person. But it doesn't mean that it's foreclosed from community caretaker from ever applying if there is some other scintilla of investigatory intent. So I think the Court of Appeals did a good job in this case in paragraph 34 saying it's basically more of a brainstorming to determine whether it's objectively reasonable, and part of that analysis is basically akin to the officer's saying this is why I did what I did. It has nothing to do with discerning what's in the mind of the individual officer or whether he was really motivated by law enforcement function, because I don't think you could ever fully determine that, and I think the cases have now foreclosed that the subjective intent cannot Subjective intent can never be dispositive. It can never render an action illegal. I think Wren versus U.S. and all the other cases in other contexts, in reasonable suspicion contexts, if you objectively have reasonable suspicion, then the officer's subjective intent is irrelevant. If, just like here, if you objectively have community caretaker under the balancing factors, officer's subjective intent is irrelevant. But I do think it could assist the court in determining whether it was a bona fide community caretaker. If I may just...
Wren was the case where the officers testified that they had pulled over the car to issue a warning about some dangerous driving when in fact they observed cocaine on the laps of the occupants. Was that Wren?
Right, it was basically saying that even if it's a pretextual reason, as long as there's reasonable suspicion objectively that it's an okay, it's valid under the Fourth Amendment.
In the line of, right, the Fourth Amendment search and seizure, that's what you're relying on in terms of divorcing this from the subjective intent of the officer.
Correct, and I think the Brigham City versus Stewart case that's referenced in the Court of Appeals opinion here is very clear in that respect, that it's irrelevant because it can't, you need to have an objective test under the totality of the circumstances.
So, counsel, part of what goes on is the officer has to have this bona fide community caretaker belief, but then you move on to the third step in the analysis. You don't stop there with what the officer thinks or doesn't think. It has to be something that society is willing to accept as reasonable. It's something where the need outweighs the intrusion on someone's privacy, and that's why a pretext stop, or pulling over a vehicle just because it looks different, probably wouldn't pass that smell test at the trial court level. That's the additional safeguard that's here, is it
correct? Yes, I think the word smell test would be a good thing, because I think, you know, there's a myriad possibilities of why an officer would approach a vehicle, and I don't think you can categorize them all in one case, but I think you basically are going to be able to tell objectively whether it's a community caretaker capacity that we want to recognize as being significant in our society.
Ms. Larson, you have, I'm interested in, let's assume that there's a seizure here, because that's the much more difficult case, right?
Right.
It's not a seizure.
Right.
We don't
then
have
we
too
don't
many
have to talk
problems,
about community caretaker.
Right?
Right.
Okay. So let's assume it's a seizure. And you then divide up caretakers into three sub-areas. I thought that was a good discussion. And you put this under public servant. And you recognize that that's a very broad area, I think you do anyway, and that it runs the danger of overreaching, because it can encompass everything, at which point you have no other law on seizures. And I'm at the bottom of page 24 of your brief, okay? And you divide it up into that the police can overreach either initially, and here you'd argue, well, they didn't overreach. There's a car on the side of the road. It has flashes on, which means beware, or something's the matter with the car, or watch out. It's in a place where you might not see it coming over the road, although it is lawfully on the shoulder, I gather. So it's hard to say here that except I think the defendant is trying to do it, so that the initial encounter is other than for caretaker reasons. But it can turn from caretaker into something else, and you have to look at the something else, right?
Right.
All right. You then, so that goes into your caretaker, and you have three distinct areas, and you find it under the third area, if I understand your argument. Is that basically your argument as to that issue?
Well, that's a way of categorizing them. They have basically fallen into these three kind of categories, and we're not
right.
Really.
Then I get into the top of 27. This court should reject the totally divorced rule. We asked you where totally divorced comes from, and you said Katie, which is a U.S. Supreme Court case on a Fourth Amendment issue, right?
Yes, that was an auto impoundment.
Right. Okay, not quite the same thing, but it's a Fourth Amendment issue. So we can't just ignore Katie, right?
Right.
So what do you mean? court should reject the totally divorced rule. If it comes from Katie, how can we reject the totally divorced rule?
We don't need to reject the idea that there are functions that are totally divorced from law enforcement functions. That's what Katie is talking about. But you need to reject the idea that totally divorced is a requirement to be
okay. So that's
the encounter to be valid under the Fourth Amendment.
And that's
because
what you
that
say.
Basically
that's what you say under one. Katie did not require that the encounter be totally divorced.
Right, and I think the Court of Appeals opinion here does a nice job citing the Cordero case, which is an Illinois case, that says, Katie was noting that many police encounters have nothing to do with crime, not requiring that they must have nothing to do with crime.
All right.
So in other words, Katie did not require the police officers to have a certain subjective state of mind in order to justify their search under the Katie Caretaker Doctrine.
So totally divorced doesn't mean in Katie that you have to be solely functioned on caretaker. There can be something else, right?
Right. I think that if that were true, then the community caretaker doctrine would never apply.
All right.
I think in order to do their jobs, police have to be aware of the possibility of danger or the possibility of criminal activity, and I don't think that should preclude them from acting in a community caretaker capacity.
And then you go on to say that the subjective intent is not dispositive, but you're willing to look at it, right? Then you go into the predominant and primary motivation test on 31. Right. Are you sticking with that?
Well, as I mentioned earlier, I think that our earlier cases do support that idea, like Bogus, I think, is how you
say
it.
So does Kyle's in a different environment.
Kyle's in a different sort of context.
But you rely on Kyle's. You got two pages.
Right.
And there's another two and a half.
Pardon?
2.5 pages on Kyle's.
Right. And there's another Court of Appeals decision under emergency aid called Lutenegger that also relies on this idea. And some of the earlier community caretaker cases that I said in my brief talk about this idea of actual motivation or primary motivation. But I do think that Stewart, Brigham City versus Stewart, potentially forecloses that argument. I think this court could adopt a primary motivation test because Stewart is distinguishable in the sense that there was also probable cause or at least reasonable suspicion for a Terry stop in that case, as well as an emergency situation. So you could distinguish it that way, but that might potentially confuse the area even more.
All right. So are you with predominant or are you not with predominant? Yes or no? And if not, whatever your answer to that is, my next question is going to be, under C, you say reasonableness under the totality of circumstance.
Right.
So is it predominant and primary on the one hand? Is it reasonableness on the other, or am I mixing apples and oranges here?
I think you're mixing apples and oranges a little bit because ultimately the test is objectively reasonable under the factors in the Anderson test. In other words, is there community caretaker function? Is it as limited as possible, consistent with the purpose, justifying it in the first instance? Is the public interest? What's the public interest involved? What are the attendant circumstances? What's the availability and feasibility of alternatives? Those things are all going to play into the analysis.
I have a problem with the Anderson case. You cite 142 was second and it's 169. That case came back to the Court of Appeals.
Right.
And the Court of Appeals, in effect, said that the first case was not the rule of the case, right? Said it could do something else.
Well, my understanding of the Anderson subsequent history is that the first Anderson set forth this three-factor test, and that's
the 142. Was it set forth in any of the other two Anderson cases?
It does not. Anderson 2 after remand.
Right. But back in the Court of Appeals.
Back in the Court of Appeals after remand adopts an objective test, and that's actually a case.
It adopts a different test and says it's not bound by its first case because it's not the rule of the case, right?
Right. And it held the seizure was invalid under community caretaker, but then it was st- state petition for review in that case.
And we took
it. And you guys took it, and you said, well, it's not community caretaker, we're not addressing that, but it's very reasonable suspicion because there was flight.
So you got the first case, which was in effect not accepted by the Court of Appeals the second time it heard it, because it was not the rule of the case. And you had a third case by this court, which doesn't deal with the issue. So you're left with the issue of what is the validity of a Court of Appeals case that's been reviewed by the Court of Appeals and not accepted by it on a second round, and reviewed by the Supreme Court, which is silent on this whole issue.
Right.
And the court has never decided what to do with that kind of case, has it?
Right, but I think the language in Anderson 1, which is talking about these factors, was directly from your case in Bees, which is 1977.
Well, you see, then you're really relying on Bees. See, I'm trying to find out what you're relying on. Because if you're relying on Anderson, that's a very shaky grounds for me. If you were relying on Katie, I could understand it. That's why I'm pushing you on this. If you're relying on Bees, I wrote it. It was terrific, and it's been in existence, for almost, what is it, 77 to 2008? That's over 30 years. So Bees and I have survived. Right?
Right, and I think if you adopt Bees in this case, that would be consistent with what the state is advocating, because you're talking about the objective reasonableness of the encounter based on, was the intrusion minimal when balanced with the public need, and it is here. I don't think the officer did anything else except say, can I help you, before the reasonable suspicion arose. And the fundamental consideration that you're talking about in Bees is that the balancing test between the public interest and the invasion on privacy, and warrantless intrusions upon privacy need to be as limited as reasonably possible, consistent with the purpose justifying it. And it is in this case, because the original justification for him approaching was he wanted to see if the car needed any help. He approached the vehicle, asked the driver if he needed any help, and that was it, because then he got the evidence of drunk driving.
Thank you, Ms. Larson.
Thank you.
Ms. Larson?
Thank you. I think, first of all, I just want to clarify that our position is that Katie does require the totally divorced rule. I think if this court holds that Katie does not require the totally divorced rule, then we have a case in which the police can be suspicious about someone's behavior, but they don't need reasonable suspicion. They can just cite community caretaker if their actions don't need to be totally divorced from a criminal investigation. So that's the first clarification I wanted to make. Second, the state has analogized this to an emergency aid case, and I don't think that that's the case here. We don't have any exigency. We don't have an emergency. All we have are hazard lights, someone parked at the side of the road using a cell phone, not obstructing traffic, not a public safety hazard. The Court of Appeals themselves said there doesn't appear to be an exigency here, and that factor favors us, but only slightly. And I think that's important in this case. We're not talking about a policeman who needs to render some kind of aid. We're not talking about a policeman like in the other cases where they're trying to prevent a suicide, or they're trying to control some loose dogs, or they're responding to underage drinking. There's nothing like that going on in this case. This is simply someone not doing anything unlawful, trying to do the safe thing. And I think the subjective intent of the officer is still going to be relevant with respect to whether the officer is partaking in bona fide community caretaker activity. And in this case, we have the officer who testified himself that he had his hand on his gun, that he didn't know what was going on in the car, that something illegal could have been going on, that Kramer's vehicle did not appear to be disabled or damaged.
Would your bright line rule require that the officer never have it within his or her mind that illegal activity may be going on?
I think that an officer is always going to be concerned about crime because that's his job, but I also think that we can look at the facts known to the officer at the time and the officer's response. And in this case, we have an officer who performed an immediate seizure and who put his hand on his gun when he walked up to the vehicle and who testified that he would not have, or that he would have.
So, to answer my question, would the bright line test that, or rule that you urge upon this court require that the officer never have a belief that illegal activity may be going on?
I think if the officer has a belief that illegal activity is going on, yes, then I think you need reasonable suspicion. I don't think you can go under community caretaker.
All right, but that leads me to my next question in regard to the language from Katie, which you seem to be relying on. And in that particular language, the United States Supreme Court said that some such contacts between police officers and the motoring public may occur because the officer may believe the operator has violated a criminal statute, but many more will not be of that nature. That local police officers frequently investigate vehicle accidents in which there is no claim of criminal liability and engage in what, for want of a better term, may be described as community caretaking function. So the court seems to be saying that when an officer checks up on the safety of a motorist or investigates an accident, that for want of a better term, those may be community caretaker functions. True?
Yes.
And then the very next line or phrase is, after functions, comma, totally divorced from the detection, investigation, or acquisition of evidence relating to the violation of a criminal statute. Doesn't that phrase seem to be modifying the term functions as opposed to subjective intent or the officer's intent?
I'm sorry, could...
So in other words, the functions the court seems to be describing, those encounters relating to motorist safety, or the stopping at a traffic accident, those functions are totally divorced from the detection, investigation, or acquisition of evidence relating to the violation of a criminal statute.
Mm-hmm.
So that seems to, it seems, going by the language, to describe the functions that fall under the umbrella of, to use the court's word, for want of a better term, community caretaker functions.
Mm-hmm. And I don't think that's what we have in this case. I don't think we have a community caretaker function because I don't think we have enough facts known to the officer at the time of the seizure.
But how does that language fall into your line of reasoning that the officer's subjective intent must be totally divorced from the detection, investigation, or acquisition of evidence when it seems the language applies to the functions that the officer is actually performing?
Because I think in a community caretaker case, you don't have an objective statute or law or ordinance to look at to say whether the objective facts known to the officer go to that violation of law. All you have are the officer's subjective concerns. We need to know what he was concerned about. We need to know why he was concerned about that in his experience and training. And I think if we say that if he's acting on a hunch that it's still community caretaker, then officers can act on hunches. And like the Terry Court warned about, we have the Fourth Amendment within the firm grasp of the police.
What would you have required the officer in this case to know prior to performing the stop or the investigation here?
I think if the car had posed some kind of safety hazard, if the car had been in the road, if there would have been something that the officer saw going on inside the vehicle that looked dangerous or it looked like someone might be in trouble, I think if there was more here, then maybe you could go with community caretaker. But in this case, there simply isn't enough. And I'm afraid that if this court holds that there is enough, then basically we said that if there's a car that's in an unusual place, it can be seized. I mean, I think that that's dangerous. I think that there's more public interest at stake in limiting the government's power and in allowing motorists to exercise caution in this day and age with electronic devices that they might use while driving. I think there's more more public interest than simply helping stranded motorists.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Ms. Lyson, and thank you, Ms. Larson, for another seizure case in our court and the criteria for the validity and the caretaker function. That concludes our hearing in 07AP 1834 CR State versus Kramer. The students who wish to stay should stay. Justice Bradley will be out shortly, and they may be joined by other students. We are in recess until 1:30.